Okay, so happy November. Can you believe it's November? Yeah, looking outside, I can believe it's November. Who likes snow? Who can leave snow behind them? Thank you. Yes. So I think I said before, my wife is in Paris, as one does this time of year. So I showed her the snow, and she said, "Oh, it's pretty." I said, "No, it's cold." So show me back, don't worry. Lecture 21, November 1st, lecture notes, page 178. As you can see, this begins the material that'll be on the final exam. So midterm two ended with the last lecture. We saw this last time, but if you're interested in hearing from a pretty good entrepreneur on the web, you can join in tomorrow, 5:30, 6:15, sponsored by our friends down the road, University of Akron. Check it out. Research Extra Credit number one. If you checked your email before you came in class today, you should have seen the opportunity to participate in Research Extra Credit number one. Add 0.5% to your final course grade. Do the survey for real. If you just go click, 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 you aren't going to get credit. He watches for that sort of problem. So we are November 1st. We're going to finish up mini test 10 on Sunday, and as a result, midterm 2 will open Monday. It'll run all the way through Saturday. This is just a repeat, more or less, of that mini test 10 closes on Sunday, and that midterm 2 will open on Monday. What else do we need to know there? Not too much. With student extra credit and PAC back number 7, closed tonight, usual time schedule, and the next one will open up on Thursday. So when we get the midterms, we're busy during that week. The details on midterm 2, actually today is lecture 21, not the main point. So we've already seen this multiple times. Anybody questions on midterm 2 for me? Because they don't remember from midterm 1. Webbies? Anything? You're good? All right. Who remembers Saturday Night Fever? Anybody? Or is that just my gen? So Saturday Night Fever, John Travolta walking along, staying alive. So they pick up on that. John has gained a little weight and age since then, by the way, with a service provider, that is to say, a credit card company. John Travolta is a disco dancing Santa in Capital One's holiday nod to Saturday Night Fever. It's November, I just mentioned that, which means the holiday advertising is about to become an avalanche. Here's one of the first spots out of the gate, Capital One's new Saturday Night Fever homage with John Travolta as a boogieing Santa Claus. So we're seeing services marketing, credit cards area service, and celebrities in marketing. The minute-long spot begins with a shot of Travolta's walking shoes, just as the iconic 1977 disco film did. Wherever Travolta Claus goes, he spreads cheer with the help of a can of glitter paint and his Capital One Quicksilver card, their ad theme. The whole thing is set up to Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees, and there's even a cameo by Donna Pascal, who played Annette in Saturday Night Fever. See if this appeals to you or if it's a different gen.
That's 2 for $5.
What happened to three?
Where have you been?
North Pole.
Disco ball for the sleigh. Nice.
Hey there. Watch this. Boom. Ho, how's the hair?
Frosty as ever.
What's in your wallet?
So I don't know if that appeals to your gen or maybe just the older gen, but we are, after all, getting attention for an old, Travolta Claus idea. The campaign continues the "What's in Your Wallet" tagline for that credit card service introduced in 2000. So use of a brand tagline that's been around for a while. Yeah. Uber Eats uses classic horror movie quotes as a promote promo codes, but you have to remember the lines. Creepy lines of dialogue are essential to any great horror movie, and this Halloween season, Uber Eats has been rewarding consumers who can remember them exactly. So we're seeing services marketing, Uber, of course, being a service, and getting consumers involved. The delivery service has been posting ads daily since October 25th, outdoors, in social media, CRM, and online video, featuring incomplete quotes from horror films. Those who can complete the quotes can use them without the spaces. Yes, discount codes for 60% off candy, decor, and costumes. So it's a sales promotion. The films being featured are true classics of the genre, The Ring, Scream, Child's Play, Silence of the Lambs, It, Exorcist, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Saw. So that's from Scream. Do you, anybody know that line? No horror fans? Yeah. Do you like scary movies? You could now submit that online for a promo code reward. How about from which movie is that? Yes, and what's the line? Yeah. 1, 2, Freddy's coming for you. Boom. How about this one from The Exorcist? Nobody? What an excellent day for an exorcism. You all should win an award. Unfortunately, when I clicked it today, the thing ended yesterday. Yesterday it was there, today it's gone. So Uber Eats partnered with a number of movie studios and production companies, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Lionsgate, MGM, and Shamrock, to get the rights to the quotes as well as associated imagery, poster designs, logos. A new code has been dropping every day. So yesterday when I clicked, the site was up. Today it tells you that the contest has ended. Game is over. So here previously you could have submitted that promo code. The goal was to have some fun with typically boring promotion codes, turning them into another creative media opportunity. The campaign is also meant to shift the perception of Uber Eats beyond just being a food delivery service, with verticals such as grocery, retail, and convenience. So we're building service awareness with this campaign. When the idea first came up a few months ago, we wanted to feel big and iconic, the level of entertainment that Halloween deserves. Just using the movie phrases wasn't enough. We wanted it to be a bit of trick-or-treat spirit so people could get an extra layer of fun. So we came up with the incomplete quotes in the execution, which invites the consumer to play movie trivia with us, getting the consumer involved in the brand, in the service brand. Finally, Netflix is an interesting service example for us. It's both B2C service. It's a service for you. Again, what do you get when you sign up for Netflix? Nothing physical. You get the streaming service. But in the B2B world, it's an advertising vehicle. So they're providing an ad service on the B2B side and a streaming video service on the consumer side. Why the Netflix Cup is a major step forward for streamers' ad strategy. This week marks 1 year since Netflix debuted its ad-supported tier. So it's a service for both consumers, B2C, and advertisers, B2B. Our goal isn't just to offer the same products and tools the industry has come to expect. Rather, Netflix's goal is to build something bigger and better than what exists today. So it's a services offering. Here they're mostly talking on the B2B side. A centerpiece of the Netflix's vision for that future adstopia is the Netflix Cup, the streamer's upcoming live golf tournament. When you think Netflix, do you think live events very much, or do you think streaming stuff? So this is sort of somewhat a new venture for them. Live streaming golf tournaments drawing athletes from its popular shows, Nespresso and T-Mobile, among others, unidentified, would be the sponsors for the live event, and it will stream on November 14th. So we're getting advertisers and consumers' attention with this new live stream idea, relatively new idea.
Thank you. there.
So they're having a bit of fun with the way they're promoting it, both to you and to the advertisers. A centerpiece of the Netflix vision. Yeah, I already said that. So getting consumers and advertisers' attention. For advertisers, the Netflix Cup is particularly enticing because it will place brands not only in front of the platform's ad tier subscribers, consumers, but the entire Netflix platform, a potential 247 million global subscribers. So if you're an advertiser and you can get 247 million subscribers, that might be worth something to you. One agency buyer, ad agency buyer, said live events that can be sponsored across tiers would benefit Netflix advertising sales numbers by drumming up competition over scarcity due to limited sponsorship slots. Hey, this is live. We're going to get 247 million people, arguably. And you can be a piece of it, but there's only so many ad slots in the hour or 2 hours. So services revenue. Consumers aren't anti-live. They don't only use streaming on their own time. They actually like live, and advertisers love it because there's more social currency. You are active in the moment of whatever's happening. So it's value to advertisers. Netflix has also launched title sponsorships for select series, starting with the most recent season of Love is Blind. You can't really see it up there in the right-hand side, but that's their title piece, which is sponsored by Frito-Lay's, Smart Food, and upcoming reality series Squid Games, The Challenge. How many of y'all watched Squid Games when it was new? Crazy show. So apparently part two, next season's out. And the final season of The Crown, although Netflix did not reveal the sponsors for these two, but new services in the mix. You can have a title sponsorship for a series. Amazon's Prime Video is set to launch ads early next year, but the advertiser enthusiasm isn't there for Amazon's Prime Video. That is there for Netflix. So here we see competition in the services arena, but also an advantage to market being the market leader. Sure, sure, Amazon Prime, you're going to be there, but I really would prefer to be on Netflix. So services in a little different context there on the B2B side. So on the lecture notes, page 178 and chapter 11, page 335 in the textbook, we pick up with our discussion of considering value in the domain of services. So we talked about what value is in general. We're thinking about it from the services viewpoint. So let's think about a particular service out there, restaurants. Obviously, there's a food component, the product side. And then there's the wait staff side, the service side, right? So value means different things to different people. Customers want more than just a bargain basement price. They equally demand decent portions, new exciting flavors. So when you provide value to restaurant consumers, they want menus for value-minded consumers, sure. So Taco Bell's combo meals, $5 meal boxes, inexpensive a la carte items, McDonald's dollar menu with $1, $2, and $3 price points, Subway rolled out a $4.99 foot long. They want healthier choices, not so much a product per se, but a benefit of it, and social responsibility. McDonald's and Taco Bell have removed artificial preservatives from their many of their items. Starbucks and others are banning plastic straws for environmental reasons. People want that value. Online ordering systems and self-service kiosks improve the speed of ordering and getting food. However, I digress by asking you this. Who's used a fast service kiosk? Now, I guess we have them over here now, don't they? But I'm thinking about the ones at the big McDonald's at the toll, at the turnpike stuff, whatever. Man, by the time I figure out where the subdivision is to tell it I don't want onions on the thing, I'm done with it. I want to be in front of a person. I don't always love the self-service kiosk as a service that they're providing me. Maybe you do. I don't necessarily. Although down here, you almost have to use it, don't you, in the student center. Faster payment systems as a service, Apple Pay, smartphone app, pay at the table technology, all are convenient for consumers. About 69% of Gen X and Y would prefer to pay through pay at the table, and 66% of boomers would prefer it. So these are go beyond just the food itself to give service value to consumers. Service image, we talked about positioning a product. Service image is the positioning of your service against competition. It's conveyed by the firm's service products. What dimension should you choose to focus on? The answer in marketing is almost always going to be the same. the ones that the consumers want. Apparently my point is about to come up. Yeah, there it is. The dimension should be used those that are valued by customers. So I don't know, when you think Cheesecake Factory, what comes to mind for you other than cheesecake? What comes to mind? What do you think of? Or you don't go to Cheesecake Factory, you don't know. Say again? Nothing? Nobody? No image? Well, they're not doing a good job then with you, are they? So we would argue that they're known for large large portions come to mind. When you think Outback Steakhouse, what comes to mind? What's the obvious thing that comes to mind? Nothing. Okay, well, here I'm going to go with, that's okay, high-quality grilled steak. And what comes to mind when you think Olive Garden? The bread. Also, their Italian, Tuscan-like audience, and I knew you were going to say bread, breadsticks as well. So what comes to mind as people think of your service, of your restaurant? And is it important to them as a differentiator? If they don't care, you're wasting your time on that particular service. Lower prices, of course. You know, consumers might like that very much in their casual dining experience. Better food. Casual dining was initially successful because it provided better food quality than fast food at a very reasonable price. Recently, fast food's quality has gone up. Their prices have risen slowly, but casual dining's prices have risen while food quality and innovation has stagnated. Ruby Tuesday, for example, is upgrading its food, but its prices are still pretty high, so people getting the service and the value that they want. Improved service. People do not want long wait times. How many of you guys have been someplace recently? We just had to wait and wait and wait, whatever the reason. Nobody? Okay. A lot of people are having problems staffing. We don't want that. Discourteous staff. Did I tell the story about going to a restaurant down at Ohio State when I was working for a company and we were doing research there? And so it's a company dinner. And this server was sullen. Not really what you're hoping for when you're having a nice corporate dinner. Eventually, being me, I had to say, excuse me, are you okay? What's wrong? What was wrong was Ohio State lost the football game, and she was just distraught over the whole thing. I'm sorry they lost, but a little more cheeriness in my serving, please. So these aren't things that customers are looking for. Chili's is trying to cut 15 minutes from a 45-minute lunch by testing Blackberries, probably something else by now. They connect directly from the server to the kitchen. Chili's is also improving its employee hiring practices, and the staff is wearing more professional-looking aprons to provide better service to you. Better-looking stores. An awful lot of our casual dining stores are 20 years old. Ruby Tuesday has redesigned all of its company-owned stores with contemporary designs and lighter colors. Lone Star replacing concrete floor with wood and installing oak tables for better ambiance, better feeling of service. Become kid-friendly. Families are a big part of the casual dining industry market. Maybe we could have kid playgrounds. We do have them at some place that leaps to mind for kids. What leaps to mind is the place that has kiddie playgrounds? McDonald's, yeah. What if we up that game and put it in some of our fast casual restaurants to draw in family? What about loaner handheld video games for the family that didn't bring one? Maybe that would be a nice service to provide. From a study, so this just reinforces what a consumer is looking for in the casual dining experience: food quality, cleanliness, service value, menu variety, atmosphere, craveability, reputation, likely to recommend. So it just reinforces what my lecture slides had to say. How about in hotels? We were talking about the Marriott. What sort of things do people look for? Plush pillows and breathable leather bed linens, soft oversized bath towels, full-size PHE balanced toiletries, complimentary refreshments, a little something special. How about a plate of homemade cookies and a welcome cocktail or fresh flowers in the room? Depending on the level of hotel you're having, that little bit of service could really resonate with your customer. Are you going to be a service leader or a service follower? We talked about that in the product domain. Are you going to set the service standard or wait for competitors to set the standard and then follow their lead? Same as you hear, being a leader offers risk as well as reward. Being a follower, maybe you can get in with less risk, but maybe the leader already has that position. So it's a decision you have to make. Until recently, Apple was seen as the, quote, innovator in the field. More recently, Microsoft has shown some leadership. So they're becoming up as followers. So just as in the product domain, in the service domain, followers can become leaders. You have to make up your mind for your company if you're going to be the leader or the follower. So what are some tips for providing excellent customer service? Well, consumers want to hear from you. If they have a question, need instructions, have a complaint, they want to be able to communicate with you. So provide multiple lines of communication, in person, by phone, on the website. If there's a question or an issue or a problem, respond quickly and thoroughly. Don't leave them hanging. Not good customer service, doesn't build reputation, people don't like it. Walk a mile in your customer's shoes, see what they go through. My sad story here at Kent State, when my daughter was here as a student, even though I'm a professor and she gets some things free, we still had bills to pay. And over one time period, and I can't recall what the detail was, we could not get them to take our money. We tried on the phone, we tried online. I had to take a special trip down with my daughter to the bursar's office to force them to take my money. You would think something a university would be good at is taking your money. No. Walk a mile in your customer's shoes, see what they have to go through to accomplish whatever your task is with them, right? Ask for feedback so you know how you're doing. Focus on the relationship, not just on the sale. Happy customers are repeat customers. If you show them how important they are to you before, during, and after the sale with your good service, they're more likely to come back to your business again and again. Seems basic, but in your own real-world experience, you may realize it doesn't always happen. Exceptional customer service can be that differentiator for you compared to the competition. They went the extra miles for me. Services attract customers. Services keep customers. Services can help you to recover lost sales. I forget if I use this example later on or now, but I'll use it right now. So my brother moved from our hometown in Pittsburgh. He retired, he moved south to South Carolina. And everybody said, you don't keep your northern furniture when you move south. Get rid of it all and get everything new for your contemporary, more southern environment. He did that. And he ordered a bunch of stuff online. Then the stuff came from like Wayfair or whatever. And some of the stuff you have to put together. You get this chair base, you got to put the back on it, whatever it is. So you got some bar stools, four of them. Three worked fine. The fourth one, man, that back was not fitting on that chair no matter what he did. And it wasn't him. The other three worked fine. He got all huffy. He called him up. Hey, my back doesn't fit on my chair. They said, they expected, you know, pushback. They said, okay, sir, sorry, no problem. We'll ship you another one. He said, oh, okay. What do I do with the old one? How do I get that? They said, you keep it. That is good customer service. They didn't fuss with him. They didn't argue with him. They didn't charge him something to ship back the other one. Boom. He continued ordering other furniture from that place. He was happy. The customer service, that would have been a lost sale, but the customer service kept him. Service quality is related to customer satisfaction. Something to keep in mind. And customer service research shows usually leads to long-term profitable ROI, return on investment. You spend on customer service, sure, but it pays off in the long run. How do consumers evaluate or purchase services? Let's keep in mind that it's not a physical, tangible product. So how do you make your mind up about something that's intangible? What we say is there are three elements to what they look at: search properties for the service, experience properties for the service, credence properties for the service. So let's look at these. Search properties are what consumers can judge before they make the purchase. Shovel, you can pick it up, pound it on the ground. You know if it's sturdy or not, it's a physical product. Haircut, tax accountant. How you judge it in advance? Well, price can be an indicator for you. In general, almost all consumers, if the price is higher, what do you think the service must be? Better, right, mostly. Location, where do I get this service from? Is your service provided in a formal office building setting? Or is it down here in one of these little strip mall areas, you know, when you're right next to the tattoo parlor and the dollar store? That can be an indicator. The appearance of the physical facilities. Have you ever been to a doctor's office or a dentist office where the magazines are sort of ratty and the floor looked like it could be cleaned a little better? What's going on back there? Paperwork, is it easy, well organized, or not? Medical services idea. If you ever go to, I don't know if you guys are too young, you go to a main doctor and then they send you to a secondary place. When you go to a secondary place, you fill out the 10-page form that you've just filled out at the main place. One time I had that happen, I went to the second place expecting this. Second place pulled out a folder, had my name printed on the folder, had all the stuff filled out in the folder, and all I had to do was check it. Made me feel pretty good about what was going to happen in the procedure, right? Interactions with the service provider's staff. Are they thoughtful, kind, considerate? Not grumpy. Experience properties. These are things that you can only judge either during or after the service experience to help you assess if you made a good decision. How physically comfortable were you during your hairstyling experience, during your massage, during your medical procedure? Does the staff seem to care for you and your situation? How long do you have to wait to get this service provided to you? None of these things can you know in advance of making the service purchase. You have to be there and do it. Credence properties. These are things that you judge from a subjective evaluation of the whole thing. You can't tell it till you've gone through it. So did the medical procedure fix your problem? Did the tax accountant keep you out of jail? What's the end result of this process? There's no way to know until you go through the process. So we talk about how these things work out in terms of the ability to judge it before the fact or after the fact. So for things like products, these are high in search properties. You can judge them in advance. Clothing, jewelry, furniture, houses, cars. You can judge a lot of that in advance. Things that you can only judge as you experience them. Well, that vacation package you bought looked okay. It was a great deal. How's the place you're staying in? How's the experience you're having? And then high-end credence properties, things that you really can't judge until it's all done. The root canal, the auto repair, did they really fix it? Your medical situation. So for your product, for your service rather, how do people judge these elements of what you're offering? How do you convey to them whatever value you're providing? In terms of designing our services, first of all, ask yourself, who are my customers and what do they want? Just as in products, you can get trapped into doing things just because you can do them. In services, they may not want whatever it is you're paying to provide them. Maybe they don't want 24-hour service. Maybe they're good with 12-hour service. You're paying a lot for nothing. What do consumers want in a fitness center? I skipped over fitness center the last time we looked at it. But what services do people want in a fitness center? There are different segments out there. They want different things. What's one thing, service, a person may want in a fitness center? Yeah. They might want equipment, particular kinds of equipment. They either want the weights or the free weights or the machines or the walkie stuff or the rowing stuff. They might particular equipment for different segments, the stretchy stuff. I don't know. What else might they want other than that? Yeah. They might like some fitness classes. Do they want the high aerobic stuff, the low aerobic stuff, the yoga stuff, different service that they might want? Yeah, so maybe they want a spa or a sauna or a hot tub or a health bar, a little place to socialize. I don't know what they want. You got to know what they want. And provide them the stuff they don't want is just a waste of your time and money. It doesn't satisfy them. The nature of the service will impact the design process. If the thing is complex, medicine, investments, you have to have lots of support services and highly qualified customer contact people for most of what you're offering. Some segments may not care, but otherwise they do care. If it's less complex, automated services, ATM machines, you have substantial upfront design costs. Why? So you have an ATM out here. I mean, this is Ohio weather, man. It's got to work 24/7, 52 weeks out of the year, whether it's raining, snowing, pouring, hailing, 100 degrees. Nobody wants to go to an ATM and have it eat their card or not give them their money. You got to be sure that you have provided solid upfront design. How do you price your service? Well, who's your target audience is one important thing to ask. How are they fixed financially? How much do they buy of this? How often do they buy it? Could influence your pricing model. Price, by the way, is the next P of the marketing mix we're going to talk about. TGI Fridays trains workers to offer its loyalty program of discounts and promotion for their regulars. Why is that? Well, regulars who get these little loyalty programs and discounts, promotions, often increase the frequency of their visits. The casual person who's just traveling by on the road, they don't need it. They aren't coming back. Regulars spend significantly more per average check. So you give them a treat, you give them a little extra service, you give them the extra attention, they come back more often, and they spend more money. That seems like a good benefit, return on investment, a special focus on those consumers. What's the type of service? That's going to influence the pricing for it. Can a fee be justified for this service you're providing? A while ago, our friends over at Timken were giving away free maintenance and inspection service for products that had their tapered roller bearings in them. They were saving companies tens of thousands of dollars on products that could fail. So good maintenance, here's a problem, you know, save yourself money, don't let it break. One day they woke up and said, I wonder if anybody would pay for this service of inspection and maintenance. Yes, they would. It's saving them a lot of money. So they justified a fee for that service. As you do your pricing, of course, you have to keep in mind the cost of the wages to do this thing, whether it's the service inspection, 24/7 customer service, the wages for really good people that you hire because they're better than the average server, the physical facilities that it takes to provide this particular feature, that machine that we talked about, that spa that we talked about, technology and equipment, well, I guess it related to physical facilities in this example, honoring your warranties and your guarantees for your service. So you want to be sure that your prices cover these costs as well. Also, as we design our whole thing, we have to keep in mind how complex or uncertain the whole thing is. When the customer service product is complex, customers uncertain about the process, they want extensive sales assistance. How are you giving it to them? Is it in person? Is it online? Is it part of a chat bot that you provide in your website? Demonstrations, especially in the B2B world, they want to be able to see how it is you're saving them all this money or bringing them all this revenue. Service guarantees, how much you're going to have to set aside for that. After sales assistance, pre-purchase information. So when you're complex, you have a lot of things to think about. If you're a smaller marketer, an entrepreneur, a small business, you may not be able to do all this service provision yourself. You're trying to get the thing opened every day, running every day, closed up every day. So you may need to outsource some customer services to save costs. Anytime you outsource anything, there are pros and cons to it. The pro is right up there. What's the pro to outsourcing in general? At least we imagine it is. You can just read it off the slide just to make me feel like you're paying attention. Save costs, okay? What's the con of outsourcing things to a third party? Say again?
Job loss.
Could lose jobs internally. You don't know what, you can't assure quality because you don't have direct control over them, so you lose control. You got to figure out these things, right? So when you use customer service outsourcing, you're expecting significant growth. You aren't going to have enough internal people to make it happen. What about having a third party who can grow that service with you? To save money, we already talked about that. You're thinking about a new service you want to offer. You aren't sure how it's going to play out. Get a third party to try it, see if it works or not before you bring in your own people, and then learn and bring it internally later. Variable volume, sometimes you have a lot of need for this service, sometimes not so much. What a pain it is to manage that internally with your own people. Let a third party partner do that. Your business model shifts. You've been domestic all this time, providing domestic service. Now you're going to go international. How are we going to go international? Let's bring in a third-party provider to help with that service part of our business. A while ago, Kent shopped out its help desk services to third parties. Variable quality, I would say, sometimes good, sometimes not, but they're saving $1 million a year by not doing that in-house. How many services should you provide? Well, you want to, again, go back to the customer, back to the consumer. You want to focus on those services that make a difference in their purchase decision. So that may help you limit the number of services to just what makes a difference. Customers may be willing to pay for some or all of the costs of the services they want. You might be able to offer a few more services because they'll pay for it. Do you want to go full service or self-service? You got to know your customer. What do they want? How many of your parents love self-checkout at the grocery store? That's what they want to do. How many parents insist on going to the cashier? That's what they want to do. Or at the bank. Some people love the ATM. Man, others want, it's my money. I want an interaction with a human being as I do whatever I'm doing. What do your customers want? How much self-service will they support? How much do they want in-person contact? And what can you support given your financial situation? Service delivery requires top management commitment. You can't just tell the front line to do good service and not support them. You want to treat your employees as internal customers. We already looked at that triangle before and said, hey, you got to make sure your employees are well respected. They understand your service promise and they're motivated to deliver that service to the consumer. And I don't remember what that is. Often I do, sometimes I don't. Oh, Trader Joe's, anybody shop Trader Joe's? Yeah, so apparently they have great employee relationships. Their employees then supposedly treat their customers really, really well. So this is an article on 5 lessons from Trader Joe's unbeatable customer experience. These in customer satisfaction. They have incredibly loyal consumers. Investing in employees creates a happy atmosphere where workers want to help customers with a smile. So they're treating their customers right. View service as a performance. What does Disney World refer to their employees as? They don't call them employees. They call them cast members. Why is that? To reemphasize we're doing a performance for our happy visitors. And by the way, that even goes down to people that aren't wearing Mickey Mouse outfits, the people that are sweeping the street. Keep in mind, this is a performance for our audience. How would that play out for your people? Ensure service recovery. Know what to do if there's a service failure. What are you going to tell people to do? When errors occur, fix them. Make sure that frontline person knows to tell the guy whose chair isn't fitting right, okay, we got you covered. And don't worry about the chair. We're going to cover that. Know the cost of losing a consumer. For every customer who bothers to complain, there are 26 other customers who don't tell you about it. How many of you have had a service failure, product failure, and you haven't complained to the company about it? I mean, how many have complained to the company about it? Okay, oh, whoa, this is a complaining group. Good for you. In the real world, though, a lot of people just don't tell anybody. The average wrong person will tell 8 to 16 other people. How many of you have had a failure on a product or a restaurant or a service, whatever, and you've told other people about it? All of us, right? You complained to other people. You didn't tell the establishment. Now you're telling everybody else. That's not terrific for them. 90%, 1%, this seems overblown, but okay. 91% of unhappy customers will never purchase services from you again. Maybe it's not that big, but how big is it for your organization? It costs about 5 times more to attract a new customer than it does to keep an old one. How could that company just tell them to keep that chair and they'll ship them a new chair? Because if he goes away and never buys anything from them again, they got to replace him as a customer. Getting new customers is expensive. Just go ahead and take care of the problem. Each one of your customers has a circle on the internet, of course, of 250 people or potential customers who hear bad things about you. Be aware of this. Successful service recovery. So Indeed, what's it take to make that customer happy? Know what that is. Two Outback Steakhouse ex customers haven't been back since a server and a manager argued with them at their table very publicly about how the steak was cooked. I don't know the details, but you can picture it. They wanted it medium rare. It came out, in their mind, rare. They asked the server if they could have it done medium rare. The server says, that is medium rare. What are you talking about? And the manager comes over and argues with them too. Is that really what you want from your restaurant? I'm not going back there. Forget about it. So bad service means you end up losing existing loyal customers. You lose potential customers who hear bad things. You can't believe what happened at that restaurant that I went to. You have the cost of gaining back replacement customers for those who went away. You lose profit. You lose reputation. And by the way, if this is endemic, you lose employees who don't feel that you're doing a very good job of servicing your customers. So it seems like it's an important thing to think about in your business. So you got to listen to your customers. You got to get them to talk. You got to anticipate potential failures so you know what your recovery will be. When there's a problem, plan on acting fast. Know what you're going to do. Train your employees to take care of the problem. Empower that front line to fix the problem. They're not going to get back to you in 10 days. They're going to fix it now. Close the loop. Get back to the customer. So you have feedback. You ask them for their opinion. You ask them if there's any problems. You get the information. You don't do anything. That pisses them off even more. First you had a failure, and now you're not being responsive. Not good. So here is one of my heroes. I love the delicate management style of Chef Ramsay. Y'all know Chef Ramsay? And so he's one of my heroes, of course, because he's so, you know, diplomatic. And here he is in one of his restaurants, helping out one of these restaurants. And he's just ramped them back up. And he's reopening the restaurant with his new scheme. And they still don't quite get it.
It's great to see the dining room full and feel the buzz.
Oh, thank you very much. Lovely.
But on the second sitting, the overbooking's causing a problem. There are just too many people. There's a table of 19, and a table of 15, and a 14, pretty much coming at the same time. And it's not very good when you've got like 48 people all at once, because it's shouting the kitchen. Nick and Richard have to learn a cardinal rule. Put the customers first, make them feel really special, and build a sense of loyalty.
I don't expect to come out for a family meal after a wait as long as this. It's not a question of fast food, it's fresh and now. We've been here an hour and a half. There we are, we learn, and we don't come back again. That's it.
You ever had a chicken carved at your table?
No.
Well, I've not done this many times.
Kim's trying her best, but charming the customers just won't work. They want to eat. Remember, unhappy customers destroy reputations.
So, that's not a group of people that's happy and coming back again, given your grand opening after you've done all this. You've done a foolish thing. You don't have happy customers. Put the customer first. Make them feel really special. Build that sense of loyalty. It's an excellent lesson, whether you're selling a service, what we're talking about here, or a product. Thank you, Chef Ramsay. If you want to know more, we have Marketing 45082, Services Marketing, to put you in more in depth with this topic. So this was one of the four P's of the marketing mix that we just started talking about. We start talking about products, broadly speaking, including services. And now we pick up with chapter 13, building the price foundation, the second P that we're going to talk about. And I still think I'm off my lecture notes, but it's in the vicinity of 188. So again, where are we in our overview of the whole marketing management process? We started at the 30,000 foot level, worked our ways down to the 20,000 foot level. We're now at maybe the 10,000 foot level. Looking at that marketing mix, we start with products and services. We move to the next one, pricing. And we've seen it in the circular view before. The point of having the circle with the customer at the middle is the four P's are integrated. They tie together with the customer as the focus. We talked about products and services. Now we move to price. So let's think about the nature of price, the importance of price. You're certainly well aware of price in general, but you probably haven't thought about it from a marketing viewpoint before. Price is the money or other considerations, including, for example, in bartering goods and services. that are exchanged for the ownership or use of a good or a service. Anybody know the Bugatti Veyron for any reason? You know the Bugatti? So that has a price for a car. What do you get for that? Well, the 2015 Bugatti Veyron 16.4, the space price was $1.7 million when I last looked at it. The 2022 Bugatti is 3.3 mil. So you're getting some stuff for that price.
The new Bugatti Chiron.
So what are the key stats? Well, 0 to 62 takes 2.5 seconds, 0 to 124 takes 6.5 seconds, and 0 to 186 miles an hour is bent over and spanked in 13.6 seconds. As for the top speed, that's 236 miles an hour in normal driving mode and 261 when you use the special speed key. The engine's quad turbo spool up sequentially in pairs from 700 RPM to 2000 RPM, where all of the Chiron's 1179 pound-foot of torque kicks in for organ-splitting acceleration. On the outside, you get the distinctive C-shape on the Chiron sides, active aerodynamics and massive cooling ducts which help feed the hypercar's 11 radiators. Inside, you'll find the finest European leather and a minimalist cabin to help make sure your attention isn't drawn away from the road at over 250 miles an hour. So what does the world's future fastest car cost, you ask? £1.9 million. And if you are serious about getting one on your driveway, you'd better be damn patient. 170 of the 500 Chirons have already been ordered, which means you'll be waiting 3 years to get your hands on one.
So you would ask yourself, who would spend $3.3 million on a car? A bunch of people, not you and I, but there's actually a waiting list to get a $3.3 million car. They have the money to spend. That price is worth it to them. What is the importance of price to a business? In our conversation, what's the importance of price? Price is the only thing that produces revenue. Everything else is a cost. Everything else is an expense. Okay, finance people, yes, I suppose if you invest your money instead of putting it, you can get. But in general, the only thing that produces revenue is your price. Everything else is an expense. So let's think about this then. What happens to your revenue and profits? What happens to your revenue if your price is too high, higher than it should be? What happens? It's less than it otherwise should be. Setting your price too high means your revenue is lower than it should otherwise be. Yeah? Let's not do that. What happens if you set your price too low? What happens to your profits? You are losing money. You may not have a loss, but you're losing money compared to what you could have if you set your price higher. So understanding your price and what the right price point is, it's pretty critical. Set it too high, you lose sales, you lose revenue. Set it too low, you lose profitability. Let's think about price a little bit. Now, for some reason, your book goes into barter. Barter happens on two levels. Barter happens at a national level between big countries. So you're a third world country, you don't have a lot of U.S. cash, but you have a lot of kumquats. And I'm willing to give you farm equipment for kumquats. So we barter. We agree how much my farm equipment would cost in kumquats, because of course I have to make those kumquat flavored ding-dongs. So we sell the kumquats on the open market. We get the cash, you get the farm equipment, we bartered it. One approach. Another approach is locally. You own a little restaurant, and you have a big glass window that looks out onto the street, and it gets dirty. People don't like it. It's not a good look. You want to get it cleaned. Do you really want to spend as much money as it costs to get it cleaned out? So you say, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. How about, dear window cleaner, if I give you a deal, I will give you $200 worth of meal at my restaurant. You give me your service worth $200. It's a really good deal for me because in my restaurant, the actual food cost is typically 28 to 35% of the price of the meal. So I'm not really giving up $200 worth of money. It's only costing me about 30% of that. So there's an example in a small business where barter might come into play. And so the price is the meal for the window washing. Everybody gets value. The price equation, not too complicated. The final price out there that you're going to charge the consumer is equal to whatever your list price is, the manufacturer suggested retail price, minus any incentives or allowances that you give to this consumer, plus any extra fees that the consumer has to pay or wants to pay for this particular purchase. For example, in a new car situation, oftentimes you don't pay the manufacturer's suggested list price. You pay the list price minus any rebates they might be offering, minus any cash discount they might be giving you, and minus any trade-in for your old car, plus any fees that they add on. So financing charges, special accessories, destination charges. My wife bought one of our many Toyotas down here at what was Don Joseph. And she looks at him and she says, you know, I really would like this car to have a seat warmer in it. She doesn't like her butt cold in the winter. That's okay. So she said, can you add that on? What do you think they said? Sure, we can add it on for a fee. I'm pretty sure that they didn't do it personally. They shipped it out somewhere. They added it on. They charged the fee. They made money on the fee. And my wife's butt is warm. Shh. So, extra fee, right? In terms of college, your tuition, your final price, is equal to the published tuition, the per credit hour price, minus any scholarships you get, any financial aid you get, any discounts you get from the number of courses that you take, you know, quantity discount, plus any special activity fees that you might pay. In the B2B world, the merchandise bought from a wholesaler by a retailer, they get the invoice price. So that is the list price minus quantity discounts, seasonal discounts, cash discounts, functional trade discounts, plus any penalty for paying late. So let's follow this up for Kent State University students. This is a view of the in-state guarantee program for 2023-2024. And this is what it costs you if you're a part-time student. So we charge you $485.80. I have no idea how they arrived at that number. For one credit hour course, we charge you for that one credit hour course a general fee of $89.90, a career services fee of $7.17. So the undergraduate tuition plus fees is $582.87. So what are you paying per credit hour, given that structure? You're paying $582.87 per credit hour. Between 1 hour and 10 hours, that's the base rate. So when you get to 10, you multiply 10 times $582.87, and your undergraduate tuition plus fee is $5,828.70. You're not getting any breaks, any discounts, any deals there. That's what the price is. Tell you what I'm going to do, though. I'll offer you a little dealio. I'll offer you a price incentive if you become a full-time student over 10 hours. So what's it for a three-credit hour course? A three-credit hour course is $1,748.61 divided by 30 classes we have together. I'm doing it by class. So for each of my lectures, you're paying $58.29. So every time you don't come to class and don't watch my video, it's costing you $58.29. I hope you're happy. All right, so let's move to 11 hours. At 11 hours, we charge you $5,323.50 with the general fee, career service fee. So the tuition is now $6,376.07. So you've dropped per credit hour from $582 to $579. If you continue this logic with the discounts we give you, if you're taking, how many of you guys are taking 15 credit hours? 15? At 15 credit hours, you're only paying $428.18 because we're giving you a quantity discount. And up to 18 hours, we don't charge you anything more. You're down to $356.82 per credit hour. So the point is, we are giving you a discount, a quantity discount. Tuition stays the same at $5,347.10 all the way across those. So the per credit hour fee is less than that $582.87 base rate. What a deal we got for you. So from 11 to 18 hours, we give you a discount for each class taken. For a 15-hour full-time student, you're only paying $42.82 for each of my 30 classes because of the quantity discount situation. So if we work this out, for a full-time in-state student at 15 credit hours with a $1,000 scholarship and a discount for the guaranteed rate, what do we got as the total tuition that they pay? Well, it's the published tuition, which is $582 times 87 cents times 15 credit hours, or $8,743.05, minus, in this example, a scholarship of $1,000, congratulations, minus the quantity incentive that I just showed you on the previous slide of $2,320.32, plus any special fees we might have. What special fees might you run into? Well, if you're a college or business undergraduate major, you have a program fee of $85. If you're an entrepreneurship major, you get a $62.50 per semester charge. If you're a distance learning student, you get $15 per credit hour as a fee. In our example, we'll say that you are a college or business major, your program fee is $85. So here we have the calculation to get to your tuition. The published tuition, minus the scholarship, minus the incentive discount, plus the special fee, boom. Your total tuition for that semester, $5,507.73. So it shows you the idea of having a manufacturer suggested list price or the published tuition, minus incentives and allowances, plus extra fees. Value, when it comes to thinking about this, is the ratio of the perceived benefits to the price that we charge. Let's think about the value of a pizza, if you will. So a small pizza, 10-inch pizza, was, when I put this together, $9.19. A large pizza is 16 inches. It's only $12.59. You are getting, if you do the geometric calculation, you're getting 2.5 times the pie for less than twice the price. What a deal! Get the big one. So we're giving you extra value because you have more pizza for less price. So, as a general rule, keep in mind that your price cannot exceed the perceived value of the attributes, the bundle, the value that you offer. So can you trick somebody into buying a product that's more expensive than it should be and doesn't give them the value that they expect? Well, sure. How many times? I hope only once. Boy, I bought that. It wasn't worth what I bought it. Let me get it again. No. So you're not going to have an ongoing repeat business, a loyal customer, or them referring people to you if your value delivered does not exceed the perceived price that they pay. Value pricing is the practice of simultaneously increasing product and service benefits while either maintaining your price or, better yet, if you can, decreasing price. Hard to do in today's economic environment. But when this was new, McDonald's new list of burgers and other items priced out at $1, $2, $3. Anybody been to McDonald's recently? Do they still have that menu? $1, $2, $3? Is that still there, do you know? $1, $2, $3 menu, yeah. Anyhow, is aimed at creating value for customers. But it looks like its real value is to the fast food giant's bottom line. The idea was that cheap, tiered pricing would put more food and drinks on the list. But it also held out the hope that customers might gravitate to some of the more profitable, higher price choices, and it worked for them. People that buy the $1, $2, or $3 menu items then go ahead and purchase more items than people who don't order the individually value-priced products. So consumer psychology is an interesting little thing to play with. You have to understand how things will play out. Consumers feel they're getting a great deal. Wow, it was only $1 or $2. But then they bought the fries and the extra drink and the other extra drink and the milkshake. All right, so the reason this is, of course, important to us is it does help us think about profit. Profit, all our accountants are going, yawn, yawn, maybe everybody else is too. Profit is equal to total revenue minus total cost. Total revenue is the unit price you're charging for each thing sold times the quantity that you sell it for, or the number, quantity that you sell. And the total cost has two components, fixed cost plus variable cost. And when you look at those two things together, you end up with profit. So we're going to return to this idea later on. So as we go to set our price, first of all, we have to think about our pricing objectives and our pricing constraints in our situation. So our pricing objectives specify the role of price in our organization's marketing and strategy plans. I do a class for people at small business development centers. I do marketing for them. And the course, among other things, is trying to get them to think about how they would work with the client. And one little question I give them involves a person who wants to start a luxury chocolatier shop. And in the luxury chocolatier shop, they're going to come up with special creations with special interesting flavors. They're going to have special events where they're going to have wine pairings with chocolate. They'll do special events at your wedding or bar mitzvah or whatever. So the question is, what pricing objective should this client, small business, have? And oftentimes they come back to me and they say, well, they're a new business. What they really need to do is have low pricing to buy market share. Does that sound like the right idea for the business I described? Low pricing to buy market share. Yeah? Yeah? It's a luxury chocolate shop with special handmade things. I say, no, 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 no. That's not their goal. That's not their business model. If they can't charge a premium, high price for this luxury product, they're in the wrong business. Change your business model. Go make some schlock candy. It's interesting how you even real-world people have problems thinking about the relationship between the business model, the goals, the objectives. What are the goals and objectives here? So it's important to think about what this would be. So there are different goals and objectives. One would be profit objectives. Here you might manage for long-run profits. And here you might have lower prices to entice loyal customers over time. You're not going to make much money on each sale. You have relatively low price, but you hope to draw them in and keep them over a long time period so that small revenue will, profit will build up over time. Or, given your situation, maybe what you're going to do is manage for current profit. You do something to cause, you do pricing to cause your profit to jump up right now, and in this quarter, it could result in a higher rating by analysts. It could increase your stock value for right now. Maybe that's your goal and your objective. Or maybe you have a target return on your investment in mind. Your investors could be putting their money anywhere. And if you're able to hit a certain target return on investment, it assures the investors it's a good investment versus their other choices. So you try to set your price to generate a certain return on the investment. All right, profit objectives. Or you might price to achieve certain sales objectives. Maybe what you're trying to do is achieve a certain dollar amount of sales. So you're going to price to get that. Or maybe you want a certain market share, in terms of dollars or numbers of units sold. So you're going to price to do that. Or maybe you're trying to achieve a certain unit volume. You want to keep your production line running at full capacity. So you're going to price to make that happen. Or, given your situation, maybe you're going to price just to try to stay in business. And certainly during our recent COVID experience, a lot of companies were just pricing to try to keep going, man, till this ended. Or social responsibility. It's a goal for some companies. In the BLM and COVID-19 era, they're going to price in order to be socially responsible for the clients that they serve. Could they charge higher prices? Yes, but that's not their objective. What are the constraints in setting price? Well, these are all the factors that limit the range of prices that a firm may set. One constraint is the demand for the product category, for the product class. In the area of the transportation industry, automobile industry, there's obviously some demand overall, not just for your brand, overall for cars in any particular time period. That's going to influence how much you can charge. But within cars, your focus is on sports cars. Are people buying sports cars right now, or are they buying SUVs right now? So that becomes a factor that constrains how much you can charge. And then we get it down to the particular brand. How are people thinking about your particular brand of car right now? So there's different constraints at the product class level, at the product level, at the brand level that you have to be aware of that might influence how much you can charge for your particular product. The newness of your product. What stage of the product life cycle are we in? When Beanie Babies first came out, we talked about them before, they were crazy expensive. What can you buy them for now? Well, 99 cents. Or if you want, you can pay $125. But obviously, they're well past their prime in terms of what's going on. Other products you can charge much more for because they're new, they're innovative, people are still interested in buying them. Beanie Babies versus the new crystal ultra-high-def Samsung TV. Are you selling a single product? Okay, well, you can price it whatever it allows you to price it at. But what if you're selling a product line, a line of products? You need to consider what your other products are selling for as you go to set your price of this product over here. People are going to see it all. So, for example, in the area of yogurt, Yoplait has its 25 Delicious Flavor Original priced at 89 cents. So that's sort of what people think of when they think of your yogurt. If you're now going to have yogurt light, are you probably going to be able to charge more than the original? Are people going to pay more for something called light? Maybe not. Maybe it has to be lower than whatever your regular was. So they price that at 75 cents a cup. Then if you're going to have something special, simple, here it's 99 cents. It's special. It's more than your original product. And then Yoplait Greek yogurt, $1.29, pegged against your original product. So your product pricing in part depends what product line you have in place and where those price points are. Also, you're going to in part have to take into account the cost of making and marketing the product. We'll talk later on, I think in this series, about the fact that businesses that don't understand their costs, don't price right, they're losing money from the get-go, and they continue to lose money. That's not a good way to stay in business. What are your costs? What's it going to cost to market it? And interestingly, one constraint is the cost of changing prices and how long they're going to stay in effect. Some businesses still, and I meant to bring home a picture of the catalogs that my wife has while she's gone in Paris, stacked up on the dining room table. She's a catalog hound. Some people still sell their products in physical catalogs. In the physical catalog, they have a price. Just about, have you ever gotten anything, clothing catalog, toy catalogs? You've seen catalogs. Those things are costly. They're expensive to make. You can't just be changing your prices mid-season or regularly if you're using catalogs. It costs too much. Things have changed a little bit with web sales because it's easy to change prices on the web. There's some small cost there. But you have to ask yourself, what's the cost of you to change your price? How long is that going to stay in effect? For a catalog, I don't know, a season? On the web, probably a much shorter time period, but you have to be aware of those costs as well. What type of market do you operate in? We talked before, pure competition. What's the classic example we've used before, two or three times, of pure competition where there are many, many sellers selling a similar type of product? What's one of our examples that comes to mind of pure competition? You. Well, down to the literal farmer. Yeah, not the farmer's market that you go to, but a market for farmers, rye, wheat, oats, you know, that sort of thing. So here, price, you don't control price. It's controlled by the market out there. It's a commodity product. In a monopolistic competitive situation, you have a bunch of companies that are competing on product features. They can differentiate their products. There are things that make them special. So price can be important. Oligopoly, they're just a few big companies competing with each other. They have to pay attention to one another's price. If they change their price point too much, competition can respond in interesting ways. Pure monopoly, they don't worry about price because they're the only person out there setting it. So the point is, depending on your type of market, you have to think about the competition. I can drone on and on, but I see we only have a few minutes left. My voice is failing, so I think we'll end on step one, identifying pricing objectives and constraints. Don't forget the extra credits that are available to you. See you next time.